But today it is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
And Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Wealth Show. I'm Zach, a senior reporter at Citywire Wealth Manager, and this episode is brought to you from the Citywire Wealth Manager Conference and Awards 2025. I'm joined today by Lord Kim Darroch, former British ambassador to the United States. This morning, he opened the conference with a fascinating keynote on Donald Trump's return to the White House and geopolitical risks that may follow. Kim, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for an excellent speech at the event as well. How are you? All right?
I'm very well, thank you. Trying to keep up with the pace of events, which is quite a challenge at the moment.
Yes, I can imagine. And we'll get into that. You spoke about the potential impact of tariffs, as well as any developments in the Russia-Ukraine war, which I'm sure we'll get onto. From a risk perspective, what concerns you most about Trump's second term? And how do you think this will be any different from the first?
On what concerns me most, this is an American president with a set of beliefs that are very different to his predecessors, whether Democrat or Republican. He essentially doesn't like and isn't a supporter of the post-war international order. He doesn't really believe in alliances. He thinks America's friends and allies have, and he says this, these are his words, been ripping America off for decades, getting America to pay for the defense while they spend all their money on the social policies and, you know, flood the U.S. market with their products. So it's a very unsympathetic view of America's friends and allies. And so he comes into office determined to right that, to make America's allies pay for American support, and to redress the trade balance, because America imports much more in terms of goods than it exports. Add to that, he's got some very radical ideas about changing America. He thinks that migration across America's borders has to stop. He's basically about tearing down a lot of the established system. So it's a very radical agenda. His beliefs are things he's held for decades. In his first term, he didn't actually deliver very much, in part because he was very new to government. He had never served any elected office before, and he didn't really know how to make government work. So the big change, Zach, this time around, is he has a team who have been with him for a few years now. Some of them were with him in his first term and understand much better than they did back then about how government works, about how to make things happen. Some of the mainstream Republicans he was advised to hire in his first term, he fired them all in the end, and he has a team that are 150% loyal to him now. And I think he has an eye on history, on his legacy. So he's determined to deliver what he basically failed to deliver in his first term. So this is Trump unbound, Trump unleashed, with the particular advantage, in addition, Zach, that he has a Republican majority, although a narrow one, in both houses of Congress, in both House of Representatives and the Senate. And critically, in the American system, there is a strong right-wing majority on the Supreme Court. So all the instruments are in place, at least for the next 2 years until midterms, to help him deliver his agenda.
It's interesting. There's also a lot of rhetoric with him as well. For us, it can be tricky to discern how much of it is just rhetoric and how much of his belief system has been formed over, you know, the decades preceding his power as well. Would you mind just explaining a little bit more about those sort of core beliefs that he actually has?
Yeah. I mean, you can go back to the 80s, and I'm sure he held them before then. The 80s for him starting to show political ambitions and to express his dissent with, as I say, the post-war international order and with America's role in it. And there's a famous open letter that he put in the New York Times, paid for a whole page on the New York Times, which sets out a number of those core beliefs. And, I mean, what he would say is, in terms of America being ripped off by its allies, there are thousands of American troops in Japan, in Korea, and on the European continent, which America pays for, which are basically there to provide security for Japan, Korea, and Europe, America's NATO allies. And why is America doing this without getting, as it were, paid for it? Because he's a businessman and he's very, very transactional. Then he would say America runs a huge trade deficit in goods, at least, with some of these main manufacturing countries. And he would cite Korea, Japan, and Germany, Italy as well, actually, as examples of this. Some of these countries levy tariffs on American exports that America doesn't levy in return. So the trading conditions are unfair. Japan, for example, I promise you, because I lived there once, will not take American rice because they basically closed off their market for domestic producers. American cars are subject to higher tariffs when they're exported to Europe than European cars are in America. This kind of stuff. He knows all this, and he's not basically a believer in free trade. He's basically a mercantilist. He believes in balanced trade and whatever mechanisms you need to get that balance. So there is all of that which he wants to change quite radically and quite quickly. And then domestically, I mean, you know, obviously, where we are in Europe, we're less concerned about what he does domestically. But he wants to get control of America's borders, particularly the southern border, across which thousands of undocumented migrants cross every year. Now, well, the truth is that a lot of these undocumented migrants are an essential and integral part of the economy in the southern states of America. And, you know, they're poorly paid. They do a lot of manual labor there, whether in agriculture or in the service industry. And so there will be some consternation in this part of America if actually he's successful in, as he wants to, return 10.5 million undocumented migrants to their countries of origin. But this is what he promised on the campaign trail, and this is what he intends to deliver. So it is a massively radical agenda. The other thing I should mention, which I think will be watched very carefully in Europe, is his determination radically to reduce the size of government, literally by firing thousands of government employees. He's already made a start on that, and he's got Elon Musk to sort of help him on this. And look, this may turn out to make the American government, you know, profoundly dysfunctional. It may turn out that all of these civil servants who Musk thinks he can fire are actually doing crucial jobs which make America work, make the federal system work. But if it turns out that it is relatively successful, that actually government can function effectively with a much smaller workforce, I promise you, Zach, European governments will look at this and think there is something to be learned here.
That is fascinating. That is fascinating in terms of Musk's department and just his involvement to the degree that he's involved anyway. Do you think that will potentially have implications for democratic norms in terms of getting someone who's, you know, never held office to run his Doge department as he does?
You could argue that it already is. And I think the legal challenges are mounting up to some of the things that Musk and Doge, his Department of Government Expenditure, are promising to do or have already done. And if any American constitution I think it's a bit unclear on some of these points, which is played will end up in the Supreme Court. But we may see some absolutely critical judgments coming through, going up to the Supreme Court and the judgments being made, which kind of redefine the extents of executive and, on the other hand, congressional power in the US system, because I think a lot of this is going to be challenged.
And I wanted to ask you a question about this kind of approach to diplomacy. And you spoke in your speech, would ask you if you could repeat this again. You spoke in your speech about an anecdote you had about Theresa May and Trump's sort of approach to negotiations as a whole.
In Trump's first term, Theresa May was the first European, first leader, actually, to enter the White House 2 weeks after inauguration. And he... Trump was very keen to meet her. And when she went in to see him in the White House, he said, can we have a few minutes, just the two of us, plus ambassadors? So I listened to this. And he said to her that he had some advice for her on how she should conduct the Brexit negotiations with the EU, our leaving negotiations with the EU. And she said, well, that's very helpful. Well, just tell me what you think. And he said, you should, before you do anything else, you should sue the European Union. And she looked understandably a bit puzzled about this and said, well, why should I sue them? We are leaving. They've done nothing wrong. It's our decision to leave will be the basis for suing them. And Trump said, it doesn't matter what the basis is. Just find something where you think you can launch a challenge and just do it. The point is about how you negotiate. You want to put them under some pressure at the start. And she didn't do it. She basically negotiated in a more traditional British fashion. But I remember Trump tweeting a year or two later when the negotiations were going not that well, and hadn't been concluded, if only she had taken my advice and done what I suggested she should do, she'd be in a better place now. So this is very Trumpian view of things. And I looked up afterwards his legal history. He's been involved, whether as plaintiff or as defendant, in 3,500 cases in court cases over the last four decades. It's how he does business. It's something that I think he is translating into his presidencies. I mean, he may not be suing everyone because the Americans generally are non-participants in things like the International Court of Justice, but he certainly believes in putting pressure on his negotiating partners. Hence, you see all these threats of tariffs and then giving countries a month or 2 months to come up with some offer before he actually imposes the tariffs. That is absolutely classic Trump. And I promise if you go and skim through his book, The Art of the Deal, it's all in there.
How can we respond to that? Because, you know, we want to prevent an escalating trade war, but at the same time, you know, maintain our own economic integrity.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, it's we will see how this goes. Some countries, I mean, he launched a trade war with China in his first term. He imposed a lot of tariffs on some Chinese products. They responded with counter tariffs. He escalated. They escalated. They then started talking about a deal, and a deal was sort of proposed in which China would buy up almost the entire American soya bean crop and some other big agricultural purchases. And maybe I think there was some American energy involved in the deal. But then basically they ran out of road because Trump lost the 2020 election. So I don't think the deal was ever finalized. But that's what you're going to see, I think, now. I mean, obviously, as when he tried to renegotiate the NAFTA deal successfully with Mexico and Canada, if you have an offer to make, you don't offer it all at once. You know, you offer a bit of what you might be able to give him, and then let it other bits out as the negotiation progresses. But the Canadians and Mexicans managed by making some concessions to him to get a repeal a different form of the North American Free Trade Agreement in his first term. So that was a successful negotiation, and they absorbed the pressure from Trump, who had basically ripped up the previous NAFTA deal, a deal that the Canadians certainly regarded as very favorable to them. So, you know, if you've got something with which to negotiate, then ignore all the noise, ignore the threats, just say, let's talk about this, get around a table and see if you can reach a deal. But if you can't, then I think countries will go down the China route, which is retaliate with tariffs on American products. The EU is already threatening this. Canada is threatening it. China is. China's already, I think, acted. So that's the other way. You respond to toughness with your own toughness, and then you both sort of staked out positions, and then you see if you can make some progress.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to move on briefly to the war in Ukraine, obviously with the heavy caveat that everything is likely to change in the next 24 hours. Depending on when you listen to this podcast, there might be an entirely different outcome. I just wanted to ask, the latest that we've got at the moment is that it is unclear if Ukraine and the EU will be taking part in peace talks, with slightly mixed messages from Trump's team. I wanted to ask what you think about this and what effect you think any resolution will have on the broader economy.
Yeah. On Ukraine, look, Trump took the world by surprise by revealing his 90-minute phone conversation with Putin and the decision they would start talks on ending the Ukraine war last week. And this sent everything into a sort of spiral because people hadn't been expecting it. And the way Trump couched it when he announced it was profoundly unilateral. So no mention of Ukrainian participation, no mention of European participation. So understandably, lots of people got very agitated about how things work. What you have now, Zach, is just some confusion, because there are people in the American system saying, of course, Ukraine will be involved. But the reality is we have these talks coming up in Saudi Arabia later this week. And at the moment, Ukraine hasn't been invited. And then you have, at the Munich conference, Keith Kellogg, General Kellogg, who is Trump's Ukraine negotiator, saying Europe will definitely not be in the talks. Now, my view on this is that on Ukraine's participation, you cannot have a negotiation about Ukraine's future and ending a war on Ukrainian soil without Ukraine being around the table. It makes no sense to do that. So I think ultimately, although these talks in Saudi Arabia may not involve them, Ukraine will have to be involved. And I think there are enough people in the American system who are saying, of course Ukraine will be involved, that will happen. On the Europeans, I don't think we will be in the talks. We will have to rely on getting briefed afterwards. It's not that unusual, to be honest, Zach. We never get involved as Europe in the negotiations any American administration has done with Israel or Palestinians on the Middle East. Back in the war in Bosnia in the 1990s, in negotiations which brought that war to an end with the Dayton Peace Agreement, the Europeans were not really at the table in that. They were at the Dayton talks, but they were basically kept in a side room and briefed every evening on what had happened. So, that's kind of normal. Whoever is in the White House for Europe not to be directly involved. And the American argument is, well, if we have the Europeans around the table, which Europeans? You can't have 28 countries there. That would be crazy. So, if you Europeans could choose just one spokesman, then okay, we might think about it. But you never do that. You always ask for everyone to be there. So there's no one's going to be there. So that's that where they are. Now, on the process, though, Europe does have some leverage here. First of all, Zelensky looks to Europe for quite a lot of political and financial and other support, as well as military support. And if the Zelensky doesn't like the deal that is emerging, he will appeal to Europe to support him and say, this is unacceptable. So there's that. Second, I can't see how any agreement is reached, even on a ceasefire, without some form of security guarantees for Ukraine. And the Americans are saying, well, the Europeans have to do this. And you've seen from what Keir Starmer said yesterday that he's at least volunteering that the UK would be prepared to be part of some peacekeeping force in Ukraine. Part of, not the only country providing it, but part of. And so, you know, Europeans will need to do that, and that gives them some leverage over the outcome, because the deal can't happen, I think, without European agreement to do some peacekeeping.
In terms of territory and Ukraine's potential or not NATO involvement, do you think Putin will get what he wants on both of those fronts?
Dan, exactly. It's a very good question, and this is the central question of all of it. Look, we don't want a situation where Putin is visibly benefiting from an act of unprovoked aggression against a neighbor. In a perfect world, that means Russia should withdraw or be pushed out of the territory it's captured, which amounts to one-fifth of Ukrainian territory, and Russia should have no say on Ukraine's future orientation, whether they join NATO, whether they join the EU, whatever. Now, Putin thinks he's winning this war, and certainly his troops are making small advances most days, though at great human cost. 1,200 casualties a day is the figure I'm hearing. But he will think, because he's winning, that if there is no deal, he will continue to win, and eventually he'll break through, his forces will break through Ukrainian lines. So he won't be inclined to make big offers or big concessions. He will basically demand everything. He'll demand both all the territory is captured, and maybe a bit more, and he will demand that Ukraine promises never to join NATO. From where I sit, this is a decision for the Ukrainians and for Zelensky. I think the more important thing for them is about their future orientation and their freedom, their sovereignty, to choose their own path, whether it is joining the EU or joining NATO or both. And I imagine it is conceivable that Zelensky might be prepared to agree some sort of deal under which he surrenders some territory to Putin, but keeps the right to choose a Western-oriented future for Ukraine. Maybe, but this is very speculative. This is a shape of a possible deal. In those circumstances, I think it is more important for Ukraine's future that they can choose whether they look west or east. I think that is critical for them. And territory, yes, obviously they would like all their land back, they would like Crimea back. But I can see how they might be prepared to make that concession if what is left of Ukraine, four-fifths of the country, can then become Western-oriented, part of these Western structures and institutions. But, you know, it's not for us to decide. It's for Ukrainians to decide that, and we will support them in whatever they choose.
Thank you very much, Kim. Thank you so much for joining me today as well. That was a fantastic podcast and a fantastic speech at the conference.
Thank you very much.
No worries at all. You've been listening to The Wealth Show with myself, Zach Sharif. Today I was joined by Lord Kim Darrett, the former British ambassador to the United States. For any questions, please feel free to email us at wmnews@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Today is VE Day. The war is
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Marks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Marks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.